One is considered to be the beginning of the Disney Renaissance. The other is the latest in what is now its 100th anniversary, for as much as that's been worth this year. The Little Mermaid. They remade it. Hi, and welcome back to another episode of They Remade It. I'm your host, Stuart.
And I'm your host, Jacob.
And we welcome you all to the final episode for the season and our, you know, more kind of seasonal final episode, as always. Not necessarily for the season in this particular case, but in this case, we actually wanted to have a special extra guest on our show. And so presenting to you all for the very first time, yes, she does actually exist, my romantic partner, Hannah. Hi, Hannah.
Hello.
Wow.
Are you happy to be here in my, well, our little weird corner of the world?
Yeah, I've listened to you do the podcast forever now, so it's weird to actually be on an episode.
Mm-hmm. And I wanted to bring you on for our resident Disney expert, but we'll get to the specifics of that. Hope you all enjoy the lovely sounds of her voice as we tear into the movies in particular for today. But kind of
I was just going to say, I am already. And I was also going to ask Hannah, how did Stu talk you into doing this?
He really didn't. I've actually been asking for a while.
Yeah.
One of the first episodes I ever saw you guys record was the Mary Poppins episode. Mm. Where you guys did Mary Poppins and Mary Poppins Returns. And I was like, that's so cool. Whenever you want to have me on, I'll do it. And so it just now finally worked out for it to be now.
Yeah, we tend to keep the big Disney remakes to one a year. Simply because there's quite a number of them at this point, and we'd rather not deluge our usual stuff outside of our, you know, normal selection of movies that are anywhere between more pop culturally relevant and we didn't even know either of the movies in particular existed. So, but yeah, we wanted to bring you on. I'm sorry it took so long.
That's totally okay.
But kind of outside of the different banter for the day, what you've been watching lately, Jake? And we'll get into our items since we've been still watching quite a few things.
Sure. I can sort of take it off here, but I watched quite a lot of things, similar to last time, where I said I had like 28 movies that I had watched. But I'm not bringing up most of them because there is absolutely no reason to. The first one would be My Little Theater Trek, which I was able to make one. I may be going tomorrow, but I'm not sure what I'm going to see. But anyways, I was able to catch one of the final showings of Miyazaki's fourth retirement feature, The Boy and the Heron.
Robert Pattinson's latest breakout in his performance.
Apparently, I did not watch the dub, so I only have passing. Okay. Yeah, I only have passing knowledge of the people involved in that project. I know Defoe is farting around in there somewhere, but I took on The Boy and the Heron, and you know what? I had fun. There's some story problems with it, but it looks good as always, which is not really a compliment you can give those movies because it feels redundant at a certain point. But I don't know. I enjoyed myself, even though the story is kind of trite and it hits a lot of the same beats that Miyazaki has been hitting for three decades now. You know, there's the fantastical elements that are weaved in with trauma from the war, which is how he relates to things. There's a segment of the film devoted to building plane parts, which is like, okay, yeah, that's his. He's got to have planes in there somewhere. You know, it's checking off all the marks on the bingo card. But is it bad? No, not by any means. So yeah,
good ear at least.
I really like that, and like I said in my Letterboxd review, I'm looking forward to his next return from retirement, because there have already been reports from Ghibli HQ that he's coming back into the office with more story ideas, so nothing ever lasts.
Yeah, it always seems like he just, I don't know, it's good to know that he keeps going at the very least. It's good to know that he's just decided, you know what, I'm just not going to stop, screw you guys.
Yeah. There's always that idea of, like, if you love something that you do, you'll never work a day in your life. And so I feel like that is what Miyazaki has taken with and ran. He's like, I love making these movies, and I'm just going to keep doing it. It's not really work to me.
Which is a lovely idea and that it, like, he clearly does love it. And then you also look at the interviews of him and he's clearly just this like tired old man, like talking shit on other parts of the industry. Like, oh yeah, he clearly loves his work and he never wants to stop doing it. But also you'll just see him sitting with a cigarette, just being like, anime is trash.
Yeah. He's such a miserable bastard, but every time he leaves because he gets sick of it and he's like, I'm in my 80s. What am I doing this for? After a couple months, he's like, oh, I really miss it. Or maybe he's just like, that was the only thing I had in my life. And then he goes back to it. So,
I think there was a tweet, and I'll stop waffling after this one. I think there was a tweet by the YouTuber Defunct Land, the dude who does videos on like old like theme park, you know, controversies and things. He did a tweet saying to the effect of, "I absolutely hate every aspect of making videos. The only thing that I hate more than making videos is not making videos." So it's a weird dichotomy to work with.
Yeah, that's sort of the ends of it all, I guess. And who knows when he's finally gone, if Ghibli will even survive, because he's really not doing anything to better any other individuals there. Lord knows he hates every single movie that Goro puts out. So I don't know if that company will be able to last without him. He's not really built it to be self-sustaining. But yeah, that's The Boy and the Heron. I can move on from there. A couple of other lighter things. Very related to the movies we're discussing this week, but I sort of dived back into the John Waters cinematic universe because of a lot of the ties to Divine, and I finally ended up opening up my copy of Pink Flamingos and sitting through the whole thing for the first time in my life.
I think I must not be as well versed on these names, because Hannah nodded like very solemnly when she heard those names. I'm sitting here like, I know those are names, but...
Well, I'm happy to have a Waters fan in the room, I guess. But the main reason I bring up Pink Flamingos is because I did also accomplish a feat, and I'm very proud of myself, even though I probably shouldn't be. But I was able to eat dinner while watching it, and I was not sick. Which
hey,
that's a bit of a triumph in and of itself. I know that the recent releases, the Criterion releases of Pink Flamingos, actually come with a barf bag as one of the inserts. And so when I opened my DVD and I saw that bag, I was like, you know what, I'm gonna do this during dinner. I don't have work tomorrow, so if I do get sick, then whatever. But you know what, I was fine. And I don't know if that's an indictment of the hype around the movie or if it's just the type of things that I watch. I was able to make it through unscathed. And also, more movies need egg delivery men to come door to door with briefcases full of eggs. That's my review.
I feel like we lost something in our society when we lost people who deliver food like that to your door, other than DoorDash.
Yeah, well, now it's exuberant prices, and you don't get a straw. So, what a different world!
I can't have eggs delivered to my house, but Ship's going to charge me $15.99 for a dozen.
Ow.
And see, that's a damn shame. My local egg barn sort of upping the prices, and you got to pay the driver. Ugh. Not worth it.
1984, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, checking the calendar right now. But yeah, that's Pink Flamingos. And sort of to get the taste out of my mouth, I rewatched Serial Mom, which is the first Waters film that I had ever seen, and I was probably too young to see it, but it's actually enjoyable. It doesn't isolate the audience because it was one of the features he made after Hairspray in 1988. And when he made Hairspray, everyone was like, oh, this is like a real movie. And so I think he kind of lost something because he kept chasing that high. He wasn't making indie things anymore. He was making studio pictures. But I do like Serial Mom. I think Kathleen Turner's good in it. This is the first time I saw it and caught that one of the main characters is played by Mary Jo Catlett, who voices Mrs. Puff on SpongeBob. So whenever she's talking about gore and viscera with that voice, it's very entertaining. But yeah, I like Serial Mom.
That's a hell of an experience.
Yeah, and... finally, the last thing I have, and then I'll let you two get to your piece, but I did watch Howard. I had been putting it off for a while, but this is the 2018 documentary on the life and works of Howard Ashman, and I deliberately did it because I knew that we would be tackling The Little Mermaid today, so I wanted to jump in, and it was kind of enlightening. A number of the things that they went over are things that I kind of already knew and was aware of. There were items, like, I was unaware that there was a big project between Little Shop of Horrors and The Little Mermaid called Smile, which I personally had never experienced because it's primarily Broadway and off-Broadway, so I've never had a chance to see that, but I always thought that Menken and Ashman went straight from Little Shop to The Little Mermaid, so I guess that was enlightening. But besides that, it was a fun enough documentary given the subject matter, and there's a lot of cool and interesting information that I learned from it. Also, it's kind of weird because it's a talking head style documentary in that you have all of these famous people that knew Ashman talking about him, but it's not a talking head in that you never actually see any of them. It's all archival footage with voices overlaid, which I actually wish more documentaries did, because that's not nearly as distracting.
It just constantly switches back and forth to, oh, interesting side pieces, and oh, here's just a dude in a room. Okay.
Yeah, from 2018, and they're talking about stuff that happened in 1987, so their face is melting, and they're also in poor health. Very depressing. Yeah.
Hey, they survived through the 80s, so that's got to count for something.
Yeah, the epidemic that was the 80s in Reaganomics.
As a whole, yeah.
Yeah, but that's it for my watch. You know what? Very, very blissful movies that I watched. I didn't hate anything. I usually hate something. That's because I didn't watch a bunch of new things in the theaters this time around, just that Miyazaki one, so good on it.
Good to keep the cortisone levels down as you get older. I every time I hear you talk about something angry or in an angry sense, I'm like, maybe I should be concerned for my friend. But then again, it's also hilarious hearing you talk shit about certain movies, so then I'm just fine with it.
Yeah, well, I kind of thrive on it, but what about you? What's angering up your blood?
Oh, as far as anything angered, not in particular anything, but we've been continuing with our increasingly long list of movies that I feel Hannah needs to see. We saw, we didn't watch Nearly as Many in this interim, but we saw Fellowship of the Ring, so that was cool. I could gush about it for hours, but I will let the person who had never seen it before give her thoughts on it.
I'm also a great person to have on a movie podcast, because I have not seen a lot of movies in general. And so Stuart was gushing about the Lord of the Rings trilogy. And I thought it was very good, the first one, the Fellowship. It ended not where I thought it would end, because I've obviously seen a lot of like things on the internet about the movies.
You got to see where all the memes come from.
Yeah. But obviously when people talk about it on the internet, it's everything kind of jumbled together because it's all the books together. And so it was weird to see the original of like where it was pieced out versus how it's all put together once all the trilogy is all together.
And having gotten to rewatch it, I still adore it. I absolutely love it. It's a movie that I enjoyed from my childhood with my brother with my brother especially. I think I'm of the, I don't know whether it's an unpopular opinion or popular opinion, that you don't need to watch the extended versions, in my opinion. I think everyone who goes on and on about it being like, oh, you have to watch the whole thing, is kind of just, it's like the people nowadays who kept going on about the Snyder cut of the Justice League movie. I was just kind of like, I'm just here for the movie that they felt was good enough to put out. Like, I know that's not always the best case, but the movie itself is already like 2 hours and a bit unextended. And it was like 3 hours or 4 hours, something insane when it was like with the extended version. I just didn't really want to do that. If I'm going to sit down and watch this, and especially if I'm going to show it to someone who's never seen it before, I'm not going to make it that much of a mountain to climb. So I think there are certain scenes in later movies that for them being cut, it doesn't make a lot of sense, but those are easy enough just to explain in context.
Well, I'm glad that you at least put it in terms that I could understand. The only difference being that, you know, Justice League and Zack Snyder's Justice League, neither of them are any good. The Zack Snyder's just makes it longer and even more boring. I don't care if there's more sense, it doesn't make it any good. And I know that the Lord of the Rings stuff is kind of on the opposite end, where I've always been a little mixed with the movies just because I'm not a big high fantasy person, but I at least enjoy them. I like it more than Star Wars. I'm not a Star Wars person, so.
Yeah, I gotta say probably the same. It feels like it's more consistent with itself than Star Wars. That's what even the original Star Wars. And at least a witch for the fact that it's based off of the works of a man who was extremely talented. And so it's kind of hard, unless you actively go out of your way to ruin it up. You know, I'm looking at eyes at the Amazon TV show and a bit also at the Shadow of Mordor series. But honestly, I consider that one basically just fan fiction. And they're just like, hey, what if we just did Assassin's Creed and Lord of the Rings? God bless them for that. But yeah, it's hard not to love it, at least in its own way. Yeah, we saw that one. Did we watch anything else major since then? I'm not positive. I think that's basically been it. We've been kind of busy.
I'm doing rehearsals for a new show that I'm in, so I don't have a lot of time to like go from work, do a rehearsal, and then come home at like 9-10 p.m.
Yeah,
and then put on a movie.
I will say, I don't know if I actually did. I ever mention that we watched Sordid Lives? Because we did.
No, you did not.
Oh, cool. Well, we watched that. It was a while ago, but that's actually the play that Hannah's doing right now. For those who don't know, it's a, well, I'll let you describe the movie/show, because I think you have a better way of putting it.
Yeah, so it originally started as a play that was shown in LA. And it is about a Texas-based family dealing with the loss of like the matriarchal figure in the family. And so there's a lot of like familial relationships, there's a lot of like small town drama. And so Del Shores does a brilliant job of blending the comedy and the heartfelt moments, but the movie, despite being directed and produced by him, I think falls short of the original source material.
Yeah, I'm going to be excited to see it in its original format, but the movie's definitely, it's hard to describe it even just like even down to the specifics. It's very late 90s kind of, death at a funeral style kind of, tragicomedy, I think. We talked about that in the last actually episode where I first saw the phrase tragicomedy.
Oh, for Tokyo Godfathers.
For Tokyo Godfathers, yeah. That's very much what this is, kind of with that very late 90s, early 2000s kind of sensibilities. Ranges between playfully and outwardly homophobic, which is kind of the point. Again, it's meant to be like a Texan small town, but it's ultimately got a lot of heart, and it's just kind of a wild romp. The character in particular that Hannah's going to be playing in the play, without spoiling much, holds up a bar, Thelma and Louise style, and then proceeds to make the people, at least one of the people in there, strip naked at gunpoint. So that's a pretty crucial scene, honestly. So
When the film came out, it had a pretty big cult following. I think in a very niche realm of like LGBTQ films, like white trash comedy. Like it is literally described as a black comedy about white trash. So if you feel like that's your vibe, I highly suggest it. If you have a local theater doing it near you who has the rights to the production, I highly suggest viewing that as well.
a pretty good little piece.
Wow.
And not
Yeah,
necessarily what
Bonnie,
we
what
watched in
the
this
hell?
past interim, but I'm surprised I didn't bring it up before.
No, I'm surprised too. This thing, I mean, I've never heard of this or
Yeah,
seen the movie version of the story, but Bonnie Bedelia's in it and Delta Burke.
Well, has a decent cast.
It's pretty wild. Yeah, I fully hadn't heard of it, and then Hannah showed it to me because she was trying out for that play, and I was like, okay, this is I'm interested in what this might be. It was not at all what I was expecting. I was like, oh, okay. I was expecting more kind of like classical kind of play style, but no, this is just a very strange family dynamic going on here. I loved it, obviously, but I just wasn't expecting it.
Also,
Yeah, it's.
not to sideline us too much,
Oh, no,
but
you're fine.
we can do that on the show because it has a sequel that came out 15 years later
Oh my God,
it
it.
with a
Really?
lot of the same cast called A Very Sordid Wedding. So maybe future
Well, I think
episode,
we'll.
ladies and gentlemen.
Might bring Hannah back for that one. Talk about resident expert. My God, that hits the cutoff point perfectly as well. All right, cool. Maybe look out for that one, folks. But beyond that, we haven't really watched a whole lot else. I've been playing games, when I have the time. I just bought and have gone through most of Subnautica for the first time. That's pretty good. It's kind of janky, which I've been finding out in a lot of games I've been playing lately, but I just kind of hoped at a certain point it wouldn't be as janky, 'cause like I know Subnautica was in it was in early access for about 1,000 years, and about every YouTuber under the sun had played it pretty much at every stage. But it's still a pretty good, it's a pretty good time. Just kind of like it very much, it's kind of hard to play at a certain point because it's just very much, you have to be able to go to certain areas on the map, but there is no overworld map, and you're also in the ocean. So it's, unless you're putting down markers every 5 feet, it's nigh impossible to consistently go back to someplace until you've done it like 1,000 times already. So that gets a little frustrating just with the amount of time sink it can be. Otherwise, pretty good. I don't know if I'll finish it ultimately. I've gotten to some of the more undersea cavern areas that are getting kind of frustrating more than anything, but otherwise pretty decent time.
Yeah,
But
I've been hearing good things about it for quite some time, for a number of years now, but I'm really not an underwater person, so count me
well,
out.
considering considering that's the last thing I probably have to actively talk about, I feel very sorry for you for the movies we're covering today if you're not necessarily a big fan of underwater, because hoo boy.
I was hiding under the covers this entire time for both
It's
of these.
like, no, not Ursula. Please, not Ursula.
So McCarthy.
That's Little Mermaid, folks.
Yikes.
Hey, wake up, wake up, wake up!
What?
Hey, have you not heard the scuttlebutt?
Your butt?
No, the gossip, the buzz, the who say what, who does that, yeah, the scuttlebutt. Well, I was flying over land and sea and ear to the ground. Then I came flying here for you to see. rice like they're penguins. Throw rice for the pigeons. They're trying to blow up the pigeons, but those are just urban legends. I know a lot of really fat pigeons.
Scuttle,
will you just listen, Sebastian? I got that scuttlebutt.
Hurry up.
You'll be like, why when I drop that scuttlebutt? Okay, now huddle up, buttercup. From the women who wash all the clothes to the hunter who arrows the bows, the chatter all over the palace is that your Prince Eric is gonna propose.
What?
To somebody nobody knows. They're saying he suddenly chose.
Who?
You sound like an owl. I'll bet it's the kid with the new set of toes.
No.
Oh, yes, anything goes. Who'd ever guess? Our little Ariel's marriage material. Time for the rice and the dress and the what do you call it? The thing with the lips when they press. I don't have lips. I have a beak, so I guess I could give you a peck on the cheek.
I don't believe it.
Say.
So, no, kicking off with the 1989 film, which was directed by John Musker and Ron Clements, at least according to Wikipedia, written by the same folks. It is, of course, based on the original The Little Mermaid story by Hans Christian Andersen. Its main cast is made up of Jodie Benson as Ariel, and also the doppelganger Vanessa later. We have Christopher Daniel Barnes as Prince Eric, Pat Carroll as Ursula, Kenneth Mars as King Triton, Samuel E. Wright as Sebastian, Jason Marin as Flounder, Buddy Hackett as Scuttle, and then Patty Edwards as Flotsam and Jetsam. Oh, and then Ben Wright as Grimsby. The rest mostly being kind of random side characters. Kicking off into the plot, under the Atlantic Ocean in a kingdom known only as Atlantica, Ariel, a 16-year-old mermaid, I'll take that from the top, sorry. Under the Atlantic Ocean in the kingdom of Atlantica, Ariel, a 16-year-old mermaid princess dissatisfied with her life, is fascinated by the human world. With her best friend Flounder, Ariel visits Scuttle, a seagull who gives inaccurate information about humans and their artifacts therein. These artifacts that Ariel hangs onto goes into her underwater grotto. However, her father, King Triton, ruler of Atlantica, says contact between merpeople and humans is forbidden. One night, Ariel, Flounder, and Sebastian, a crab who serves as Triton's advisor and court composer, travel to the surface to watch a birthday celebration for one Prince Eric. Ariel soon quickly falls in love with Eric at first sight. However, a storm later wrecks the ship and knocks Eric overboard. Ariel rescues Eric and brings him out off to shore. She sings to him, but leaves just as he regains consciousness to avoid being discovered by the humans. Eric vows to find the girl who had saved him. Discovering a change in Ariel's behavior, Triton questions Sebastian and learns of her love for Eric. Outraged, Triton travels to Ariel's grotto and destroys her collection of artifacts in a misguided attempt to protect her from humans. After a remorseful Triton leaves, two eels named Flotsam and Jetsam convince Ariel to visit Ursula the Sea Witch. Ursula makes a deal with Ariel in order to transform her into a human for 3 days in exchange for Ariel's voice, which Ursula puts into a nautilus shell around her neck. Within these 3 days, if Ariel receives a true love's kiss from Eric, she will remain human permanently. Otherwise, she will transform back into a mermaid and belong to Ursula forever. After accepting, Ariel is given human legs and taken to the surface by Flounder and Sebastian. Eric finds Ariel out on the beach and takes her to his castle, unaware that she is the one who rescued him earlier, because Buddy apparently cannot decide that this woman who looks eerily like the person who saved him before, it might be her, simply for the fact that she can't speak. Ariel spends time with Eric, and at the end of the second day, they almost kiss but are thwarted by Flotsam and Jetsam, who want to basically screw up their deals in order for Ursula to get her way. Furious at Ariel's close success, Ursula disguises herself as a young woman named Vanessa and appears on shore singing with Ariel's voice. Eric recognizes the song, and Ursula casts a hypnotic enchantment on him that makes him forget all about Ariel and only be slave to her desires. The next day, Ariel discovers that Eric will be married to Vanessa that night. Scuttle discovers Vanessa's true identity as Ursula and informs Ariel, who pursues the wedding barge out onto the ocean. Sebastian informs Triton, and Scuttle disrupts the wedding with the help of various sea animals. In the chaos, Ursula's shell is destroyed, restoring Ariel's voice and breaking the enchantment over Eric. Realizing that Ariel was the girl who saved him all this time, Eric rushes to kiss her, but the sun sets and Ariel transforms back into a mermaid just before he can. Turning back into her true form, Ursula kidnaps Ariel and returns to the ocean. Triton confronts Ursula and demands Ariel's release, but the deal is invoidable. At Ursula's urging, Triton agrees to take Ariel's place as Ursula's prisoner, giving up his trident. Ariel is released as Triton transforms into a polyp, which is apparently a specific creature, and loses his authority over Atlantica. Ursula declares herself the queen of the seven seas, but before she can use the trident, Eric appears with a harpoon and attempts to kill Ursula with it. Ursula attempts to kill Eric in turn, but Ariel intervenes, causing Ursula to inadvertently kill Flotsam and Jetsam. Enraged, Ursula uses the trident to grow into a massive size. Ariel and Eric reunite on the surface just before a gigantic Ursula separates the both of them. She then gains full control over the ocean, creating a storm and bringing sunken ships up from the surface. Just as Ariel is about to be killed, Eric commandeers one of the wrecked ships and impales Ursula with its splinted bowsprit. Oh, that's, it specifically uses the term bowsprit, which goes to another Wikipedia article. That's fun. Well, it's the pointy bit at the front of the ship. That's what she stabbed. That's what Eric stabs her with. With Ursula dead, Triton and the other polyps in her garden revert back to their original forms. Realizing that Ariel truly loves Eric, Triton turns her into a human and approves of her marriage to Eric. Ariel and Eric marry on a ship and depart, with all of Ariel's friends and family watching them as they go. But thankfully, the remake is basically just a, you know, one-to-one remake with some extra details. But for the details of it, this is the 2023 film. It is directed by Rob Marshall with a screenplay by David Maggie. It is based on Disney's original Little Mermaid and also the work of The Little Mermaid by Hans Christian Andersen. Its main cast is made up of Halle Bailey as Ariel, Jonah Howard King as Eric, Melissa McCarthy as Ursula, Javier Bardem as King Triton, Norma Dumazueni as Queen Selena. Oh, she actually has a name. It always just calls her the Queen in the subtitles. Art Malik as Sir Grimsby, David Diggs as Sebastian, Jacob Tremblay as Flounder, and Awkwafina as Scuttle, which that was unexpected. But yes, the plot is, you know, the plot is nearly one-to-one with a few notable exceptions. There's a bit more gone into the backstory for Ariel and kind of her sisters and that sort of thing. The subject of her deceased mother is brought up in comparison to, I don't believe it's brought up at all in the original. There's a lot more screen time with Ariel and Eric together. There's a lot more chances for, like, chemistry to build and that sort of thing. There's a bit more kind of direct commentary of, you know, sea life against humanity and that sort of thing, and humanity's destruction of sea life environments and that sort of thing. And most notably, I think, in the very end, is the fact that Ariel is actually the one to pilot the ship to kill Ursula in the end, rather than Eric, which was a surprising flip of the script that I wasn't expecting. But truly, beyond that, and a few sprinkled details, which I'm sure we'll get into, that's pretty much it. It's about as faithful of a remake as it can get, which, you know, it's Disney, so that's not surprising.
The only difference that you really left out is that the 2023 Little Mermaid is an hour longer.
Yes.
It is a full hour extra, which I will say the credits themselves take up another, like, 15 minutes, so I guess that kind of undercuts it a little, but still.
Always. And you know me, I gotta sit through the credits, so...
Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. But yeah, we were watching the first, which in true Disney classic fashion, you know, like an hour and a half, hour 45 for an animated. And we were getting ready to watch the remake. We're like, holy cow, I cannot believe it is that much longer. Like with the additional songs, the additional scenes, I truly think that it would not have made the movie that much longer.
Yeah, but as it is, I'm sure we will get right into the specifics of that guy. Because there's a few notable additions that are like, a little questionable, I'll say. But I think I'll let you take care of the full circle this time around. I imagine there will either be none at all or way, way, way too many.
All right, well, let's get into it. Okay, we'll jump right into it with the 1989 Little Mermaid. We're starting off with a very Phil Harris sort of figure in Ben Wright, who was kind of in-house at Disney Animation in terms of voiceover work. He was Grimsby in The Little Mermaid. He was Rama in 67's Jungle Book. And he was Roger Darling in 1961's 101 Dalmatians.
Oh, yeah. Also, for a second there, I thought you were just referring to him, like, with a pet name. It was like, Roger Darling. It's like, no, that's his last name.
Oh, my favorite character.
My darling Roger.
Buddy Hackett, of course, was Scuttle. We've seen him before as Benji in 63's It's Mad, 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 Mad World, and as Marcellus Washburn in 62's The Music Man from Meredith Wilson.
Oh, yeah. Okay, that's where the voice is recognizable.
Edie McClurg was Carlotta in The Little Mermaid. She was also Helen Shears in 1976's Carrie from Brian De Palma.
Cool.
Kenny Mars was King Triton in The Little Mermaid. He was Inspector Kemp in 1974's Young Frankenstein.
Oh. Really? Huh.
Yeah.
Didn't expect that one.
Also, well, I guess I should say his name is Kenneth Mars. I call him Kenny Mars like I know him.
My buddy Kenny.
Moving on from there is one that's really obvious, but unbelievably, I'd never put it together before. Patty Edwards as Flotsam and Jetsam in The Little Mermaid was also the voice of Gozer the Gozerian in 1984's Ghostbusters.
Oh, wow. I felt
very stupid upon realizing that.
That's a wild one.
And finally, for the 89 one, we have Jennifer Darling, actual name, not pet name, Jack Angel, Frank Welker, and Charlie Adler, who have all done voices for The Little Mermaid, Aladdin, Beauty and the Beast, Space Jam, 2018's The Grinch, etc. Like, just the fact that I threw Frank Welker in there means that you know the list is going to be long, because we have talked about him, I think, 12 times in 12 different episodes on the show because people just pay him to make dog barks and horse whinnies and shit.
It's surprising whenever, like, I look, I'm surprised at a certain point they don't just get, like, public domain noises for animals with the amount of times I see, oh, credited as the horse. I'm like,
I honestly have no idea, but I did hear Rob Paulsen say once that people would hire Frank Welker to do animal noises because when they used library sounds for things like tigers, they were like, yeah, but that doesn't really sound like a tiger. So apparently Frank Welker is a better animal than actual animals.
All right, fair enough.
Moving on to 2023's Little Mermaid. We only have three, so this will be shorter. Art Malik was Sir Grimsby in the new Little Mermaid. He was also Sing in 2010's The Wolfman, which we just talked about.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Didn't really recognize him, honestly.
Melissa McCarthy, of course, was Ursula. She was Abby Yates in 2016's Ghostbuster, throwback to almost 5 years ago when we did our second episode ever.
Oh my god, yeah.
And finally, Awkwafina was the voice of Scuttle, the diving bird, in the Little Mermaid remake. She was also Constance in Ocean's 8 and Rebecca Quincy in Renfield, which, again, we just talked about.
Yep. Which, yeah, I forgot that she was in Ocean's 8. I was trying to place it. I was like, wait, we talked about Awkwafina before? It's like, yeah, she's one of the characters. Huh.
Yeah, one of the two They Remade It Again episodes we ever did.
Yeah,
But that's it for Full Circle. No more, no less.
Fantastic. Now, normally I'd hand it off to you, Jake, to give your initial thoughts, but I think I'll get Hannah's initial thoughts on these two movies, because you had seen the remake pretty much immediately when it came out, I believe. Like, this was back in, like early, like, May or something? What was it?
It was sometime earlier this year. I went and saw it at the Alamo.
God rest.
Oh, man.
I wish
an Alamo so bad!
Oh, same. Like, we've lamented the fact that we're nowhere near one. I think there's one in, like, there's one north of us in this undisclosed location.
It's in Rock. Oh, what
we say? I've joked about it throughout the show about, like, I make some random things. Like, I tell them we're in the south, and that's pretty much all I've really given specifics to. But I've gone things like, you know, in my deep Siberian bunker or whatever. So if you want to say, you can. But I've never really bothered.
Oh, okay, it's 4 hours away.
Cool.
But when I visited my old romping grounds and visited my best friend, I knew I had to go see it at the Alamo. That was the only choice that we had.
Mm-hmm. Did they do anything special for that one?
No, and there was no special menu, and I was really sad about it.
No, what? Well, we've already gotten a pretty big detraction on the remake, so good start.
even Sonic had a special menu.
A previous Disney remake, The Lion King, also had a special menu. They had like a slimy yet satisfying shake. Mm-hmm. With gummy worms in the bottom.
Ooh.
And so I was really disappointed to find out that there was no, like, Little Mermaid special menu, no special shakes, no special, like, seafood options, nothing.
But back to the point of the movie, because trust me, don't worry about waffling, we do it all the time. But I want to get your idea of, like, what are your just general initial thoughts about, really both movies, but I guess starting specifically with the original, because I know this is one of your favorite Disney movies, I think, or at least it's up there.
It's definitely up there. I mean, this era of, like, Disney animated movies, the Renaissance, mm-hmm. is my favorite era of Disney movies. I would actually say that my favorite is The Hunchback of Notre Dame. But there's just this classic air of, like, Disney princess. It's such a romantic story. Mm-hmm. Now that I watch when I'm older, it doesn't hold up in that sense.
No, the I'm 16, I'm not a child anymore comes to mind.
Yeah. But obviously, I still have a soft spot for it. I grew up watching Disney animated movies with my mom, so that was really special. And for Disney remakes, seeing the new one, I was actually decently impressed with how well they stuck to the original material while adding in some new things. I still think the remake doesn't hold up to the original just because it has that nostalgic factor for me, but I really did enjoy the remake, and I really enjoyed the casting of it.
Mm-hmm. It's honestly pretty impressive with its casting, I won't lie.
I was surprised by a number of the people that they actually got for the remake. I was not expecting Javier Bardem to show up. And
when I saw that in the trailer, I was like, I've seen No Country for Old Men. This is a very wild shift.
Yeah. And Melissa McCarthy, I was surprised when it was announced. Obviously, that was announced for an eternity ago, so I wasn't surprised when I saw her in the movie. But when the announcement came out, I was like, what? That being said, Awkwafina, not surprised at all, because every time I turn my damn head, she's in a movie. And she needs to watch out because I'm getting sick of her, shtick.
I think she has a very fun voice at the very least, but sometimes it's coming onto that whole Ryan Reynolds thing of they very much just kind of play themselves, or at least the popularized version of themselves in basically everything they're in. And at a certain point, you start to go, I mean, can we do other things too?
please?
Yeah, or like a Chris Pratt. I feel over inundated with them, and they're like, oh, this tested well. That means they want this person in every single movie that comes out, right? I'm like, no, I really don't. I could use a break from Awkwafina. It's been going on years now. I feel the same way about Ken Jeong. He's in literally everything now.
I think, I don't necessarily have a deep connection with Little Mermaid. I think like early on, I think for a lot of the Renaissance era, I kind of just skipped over a lot of it in my development. I think we just kind of, I mean, obviously I was born, at the near end of the Renaissance period, but I think maybe my brother and my sister may have seen more of that stuff. But for me, I pretty much started off my journey with Pixar almost immediately. And then also with Tarzan, which was Tarzan the Renaissance, or was that like the end of the Renaissance?
That was 99.
I was saying it was either 99 or 01. Yeah. We get it mixed up.
Yeah, it was 99. And the only reason I know that is because that was the first movie I have memories of seeing in the theater.
Mm. Yeah, mine was Toy Story 2, I believe. So that kind of goes to show, which I think, obviously, I was shown Toy Story 1 at home prior. But it's just, I never really had a genuine connection with the Renaissance movies, and especially with Little Mermaid, since it was, what, like I said in the Stinger, arguably the beginning of the Renaissance. It's fun seeing all the little kind of moments of transference from the 80s into the 90s, like the dress that Ariel is in at the very end when she becomes a human. It's like, wow, that is the most 80s sequins dress I have ever seen. It's hilarious.
First prom or homecoming dress.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily have a lot
of biases going into this one.
Well, just for a good baseline, because we heard what Hannah's favorite Disney picture is. What's yours, Stu? I'm sure you've said it on the show in the past.
I keep going to Up. It's like, no, it's Pixar, specifically Disney animated.
What's it? Treasure Planet or Atlantis?
It was Atlantis.
You seem like an experimental person.
It was Atlantis. It's obviously it's Atlantis first. A close second is Treasure Planet.
you always have struck me as that sort of era, that early 2000s experimental.
Yeah.
Sort of time frame.
I got no shame on that one. Plus, like, I'm pretty sure Atlantis is the reason I like steampunk as a concept, so I can't not credit it with it being a pretty developmental film, in case it wasn't entirely obvious. So yeah, probably Atlantis, pretty hardcore on that. As far as like ones that might be a musical, though, I have no idea. I've never really just truly vibed with like Disney musicals as a whole, really. Not to any detriment, but
you can't enjoy Phil Collins's beats and rhythms in Tarzan.
I do love them. I just don't know if I'd call Tarzan my favorite movie.
So good.
Also, I wouldn't necessarily call that a musical.
You tell me Rosie O'Donnell singing Trash in the Can is not musical to you.
She goes boo-wop, she do. And slams trash can lids together, or whatever that is.
You know what? Fine. Fair. I'll take that. I can accept that. So I guess probably Tarzan would have to be, like, as far as like the less experimental side of it, yeah, it would probably have to be Tarzan. Which even then, I would even debate there is some experimentalness. It's definitely different from a lot of the rest of the Renaissance ones. But, you know, it's also just adapting a different style of thing. I say that as if Disney has ever shied away from, you know, interpretations of stuff. For God's sake, we have Hamlet with Lion King, which I've joked about plenty before, but, you know.
Well, I'm glad that we have a good baseline going into this, and I'm kind of glad that we sort of segued immediately into the musical discussion of this.
Mm.
Because that's something that I definitely wanted to touch on. Obviously, as I was mentioned before we actually went into the plot synopses, the Macon Ashman connection with this movie, and then the first couple, I know that they both did Beauty and the Beast, and then they both kind of did Aladdin, but Tim Rice stepped in. Mm-hmm. So that permeates a good chunk of the early Renaissance there. Mm-hmm. And I was surprised that there wasn't a huge diversion from the actual scoring or orchestrations of those pieces in the remake, probably because they would have been crucified if they had.
Mm-hmm.
But that being said, there are still things seem off with a lot of these songs, and that's nothing saying for Halle Bailey, who I'm not really fond of her as an actress, but she can sing very well. I just don't think she's directed very well. There are certain things I kind of look for going into musical performances that I don't think is there. It just sounds like something that I could hear her singing on a CD in my car. Which is fine. Again, she has a good voice. But there's a lot of the showiness that I'm kind of missing from this.
Mm-hmm.
And my main complaint is honestly got to be Under the Sea, that sequence. I found it so horrendously boring. Just because they don't have all these fun undersea characters that are singing the song with Sebastian. It's just David Diggs doing his best with what he's been given, and then eventually Halle Bailey as Ariel has to chime in because no one else is singing the song. They're just they're flying around in outer space or under the sea, whatever. And we get some cool visuals with these jellyfish and then the sort of extended undersea sea stars that show up. And those are all cool things to look at.
Yeah, just kind of them bragging about the fact of like, oh, hey, sea life is weird. Look how we've rendered it.
And that's so cool. But then there's like, where are all of the fun undersea characters singing this song? It's funny because Sebastian is singing about all these things like the carp plays the harp, the place plays the bass. You don't see any of these things happening. There's no crustacean band. He's singing by himself. And that was kind of the most damning thing to me is, aside from Poor Unfortunate Souls, it doesn't feel like anyone's having any fun.
That's a qualm that I have with this film too. So I guess kind of going into Little Mermaid Disney lore. Obviously, we have the original. We have Little Mermaid 2, Return to the Sea. We have Little Mermaid 3, which is a prequel. But in that, we also had a Broadway musical, which had some of the best additional songs to the original plot. What really threw me off about this is a lot of the original background orchestrations, they completely lost by adding in these new songs. So, like, a lot of the background orchestrations that you hear throughout the castle in the second half of the movie are turned into these brilliant quartet songs. And I get why Disney added in these new songs. It's so they can try to go get Oscars. But it truly, I agree with you in that it lost the genuine...
The joie de vivre.
...of the music. They are very much goading for the modern pop audiences and also throwing Lin-Manuel Miranda in anywhere they can get him.
I literally said when the Scuttlebutt song came up, in which Awkwafina hip-hop raps, essentially, for the scene where they've learned that, oh, they're going to, like, Eric's going to propose to someone. Instead of that being a maybe 30-second scene, it gets turned into a 2-minute song. I literally said out loud to Hannah when we were watching that, and just without knowing anything about anyone who had written about the lyrics or anything, I just said, I don't know why, but I want to blame Hamilton for this. And you literally told me that Lin-Manuel Miranda was the person who wrote the music. I was like, I knew it.
It's so obvious. He really is a one-trick pony, which is a shame, because I can hearing him actually interact with folks that he looks up to, like Alan Menken, who assisted him on this soundtrack, or Weird Al Yankovic, who is like an idol of his. He has good musical sense, but I think the success of Hamilton has pointed his career in a very specific direction that I don't really care for, so it's easy for me to ignore a lot of the stuff that he does, until I have to watch something for this show, that is.
Yeah, that usually tends to do it.
And the funny thing is that Scuttlebutt song is so bad, but honestly, it's not my least favorite song in the remake.
Yeah.
There's this song that Prince Eric sings.
Oh. Awful.
It sounds like Franz Ferdinand wrote the song. It's like...
Yeah, it is so out of nowhere with its tone and its like its beat and everything, just compared to everything else around it. It very much was just like... And again, I said this while we were watching. I was like, this just feels like a modern pop song that they have like rehashed into the middle of this Little Mermaid production. And that's because it basically is. But I was like, what the hell is happening? Why are we watching this boy have his emo moment?
I don't remember if we talked about it on the show when we did the Alice in Wonderland episode, which Alice in Wonderland is my favorite Disney movie, but the Tim Burton Alice in Wonderland has a soundtrack where a bunch of musical groups did songs that just never made it into the movie. And there is one of them that Franz Ferdinand does based on the poem, The Lobster Quadrille. And if you listen to that song, it sounds exactly like this Prince Eric song.
That's fantastic. It really
took me out of it.
It's... The thing about it is, like, there was like at least one good song that they added. What was the name of the one the first time, I believe?
Out of all the songs that they added, I think For the First Time is the one that feels like it fits in the most, but it still truly just does not fit right into the vibe and into the story of the show.
Mm-hmm.
Or of this movie.
Yeah. It very much is the whole thing of, there's also a lot of moments in this I realize where a lot of songs are interwoven with scenes now, like especially For the First Time in particular, where she's singing the song where she's first coming up on the land and she's experiencing all these new human things. But it's interspersed with her like with dialogue from other characters kind of just directed at her and like remarking at her. And so essentially this song effectively lasts like 10 minutes where we're listening to them, you know, commentate and everything, and then interacting with people in the village. And it only really ends after finally getting to the castle and meeting Eric, and she's disappointed that he doesn't recognize her. And it's just, it's kind of this, it's a weird pace in general with it, where it's just like, oh, the song's still going? Okay, we're still doing this. Okay. It's
that bit specifically made me think that Menken and Miranda were trying to capture the opening to Beauty and the Beast. Oh. That operatic bell number, which is like the go about town, here's kind of the introduction to things. Yeah. But it's not at the beginning, it's in the middle, and it's transposed with this sense of wonderment and discovery. But I got that same kind of vibe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just like trying to have the whole fish out of water thing, literally. Which I'm surprised it took me that long to make this joke.
But still, what frustrates me the most is that they had other songs that they could have used from the original Broadway show, and that would have fit so much better, and they didn't use them. So in the Broadway, they have one called Beyond My Wildest Dreams. And it's that same idea of Ariel has lost her voice, but it's her thoughts through song of like being on land for the first time and like how beautiful and wonderful and amazing it is. But then just to throw this extra song in there that doesn't fit in, that last 10 minutes is so disingenuous, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I suppose I should probably shift over to also talking about the original, because as it is, we've been talking about the remake quite a bit. But it's also difficult to do that, because I even said this when we watched the original, because in the subject of pacing, the pacing in the original is fantastic, honestly. Like, as far as a classic Disney movie goes, it does not get much better than this one, it feels like. It almost feels like you can feel its pulse at a certain point, and that's not a bad thing, honestly. It's able to do everything it wants to do with the information it wants to present to us, and I have a lot of respect for movies back then for having done that, because god damn if we had a lot of, you know, episodes on this where it's a remake that tries to hash out more from the original in one aspect or another, and it just ends up kind of feeling bloated. It's like, I've learned to really like, not even necessarily conciseness, just no unnecessary additions. And the original just, it has a certain respect for the audience in that of going, here's the situation that's going on. Yeah, there's no mother in this situation. We don't have to talk about it. She's just this girl who's a teenager who wants to experience a life that she hasn't experienced before. Let's roll with it. Let's throw in some magic. Let's throw in some danger. Let's stab a big-titted Cthulhu with a ship, and we're done. It's like, okay, cool. We're good. I don't know necessarily how to gripe about it is the problem. It's almost a detraction of, what do I pick from this? It's so well put together, it's almost boring.
Can I just say, and then I'll jump back towards the 89,
yeah,
but that shit in the remake with the mother, I called it before I ever watched this movie, because they did the same exact thing with the Beauty and the Beast remake.
Oh, yeah.
It's all this kind of upsetting parental stuff, which Disney does have a history with, but it's kind of unnecessary. I just knew they were going to pull that.
There's a lot to compare to the Beauty and the Beast remake, honestly.
Yeah, which I know that you actually liked just fine. I have a different opinion, but...
I think I would agree with you on that one, Jake.
Yeah. Well, don't agree with me too far. I don't know what your thoughts on Jungle Book are, but I like the Jungle Book remake. We all have our flaws.
Not fair.
Yeah, I had something and I totally forgot what it was.
Oh, don't worry, that happens.
Oh,
all
I'm
the
sorry.
Time.
Oh, it's totally fine. I remember now. To go on to griping parents and adding Prince Eric's mom into the story.
Story of my life.
What bothers me so much about it is we already have so much of one griping, controlling parent. Why do we need to add in another?
Yeah, I kind of pointed that out at the end of it, where ironically, like, weirdly enough, in the original, we get this whole thing where, yeah, King Triton's being the griping parent, and we don't learn anything about Ariel's mom. It's just kind of assumed she's not in the picture for whatever reason. It's never really given any amount of time of day, as far as I can remember, in the original. And then in the remake, it's given a bit more context of, oh, she was killed by humans in some capacity. And so, like, there's a reason for this animosity towards humans and everything. It's like, all right, fine. It's a bit ham-handed, but we can work with it. And then here comes the new queen lady, who's the mother of the prince, who, like, we don't know in what capacity this woman is a queen of, because it's never established, like, what this island is. Obviously, it's a fictional island, but it's clearly meant to be in the Caribbean. And I think it's based on the accents, it's at the very least meant to be a parallel to Jamaica. And if that's the case, they didn't have an independent queen. I'm just going to say that there was an English colony. So that doesn't really make any sense on its own. But it's also just the fact of, it's talked about, like, okay, yeah, the queen seems to have adopted Eric, because she brings up that he was found in a shipwreck one day. But they never bring up his dad.
So complicated.
Yeah, they never bring up the fact that he has a dad. And so it's just doing the thing from the original movie where here's the griping, controlling parent wanting the safety of this child without any context given for the other parent. And so now I just have to assume in another 30 years that we'll get another remake that touches on that person. It's like, what is happening?
And that's the thing, too, is that, again, like you said, Ariel already has this relationship, so we already see this in the movie. Maybe the explanation is that they wanted to mirror Ariel's environment with Eric's environment so that you felt that they had more in common than they would have in the original, which is all well and good, but it's not fleshed out well. Mm-hmm. They make it overly complicated with this whole she's like queen of this undefined land and Eric was adopted. Like, all this nonsense that's just, like I said, it's way too complicated.
Which I guarantee also, they threw that in as a throwaway line to justify the fact that the queen is black and Eric is clearly not. But
probably,
like, beyond that, it's like they could have just not said anything about it. It's a fantasy film. People are griping about Halle Berry being the mermaid anyway. Like, let's just toss this in and be like, yeah, this is just my kid. He's just kind of pale.
And also, if they wanted to explore that relationship with Eric, they already had that in the original with Eric and Grimsby. Now, Grimsby was never his father, but he was like a parental figure. So they already had that right in front of them.
And he's even more so a parental figure in the remake, honestly. He acts like a good father. I'm surprised they didn't just make him his father in this.
It's so unnecessary. And honestly, they just ruin Grimsby as a character entirely because I don't know. He's a lot younger, so you almost get the feel, or at least I did, that he was more of a contemporary of Eric than anything, as opposed to a parental figure. But then also, he does nothing but spout exposition. That is, like, his job, is like, well, it is your birthday, Eric, and I don't want you lost at sea, like, you know, I know you miss your father, and the way that the king, or the queen, doesn't let you go out on, like, he says all this nonsense, and doesn't actually start to develop a character until halfway through the movie, and by then it's already too late.
The other thing I don't like about Grimsby's character is now, in this remake, they have Carlotta, and they have the queen, and he has so much involvement with both of them, that it almost seems romantic in nature, even though it's not. And so that also throws Grimsby's character from the original out the window of, like, that was not a thought in his mind. His primary goal was to take care of Eric and make sure that Eric was safe. And now that they've thrown these extra characters in or have really fleshed out these characters from the original, it really kind of detracts from Grimsby's character from the original.
Mm. Yeah, it's... And I think it also kind of goes on with they wanted to try and pad this out a bit more, like to be a bit more true feature length, which is... fine in its own sense, I guess, when it's done well. Which I will say, we've said a lot of negative things about the remake. I do kind of want to touch on one of the more positive aspects in my mind that actually relates to the padding, that being the chemistry between Eric and Ariel in the remake. I think it is so much better. It is so, so, so much better than the original, where they barely interact, it feels like. It's like they're actually in this place and they actually do have things. The moment where we see Eric's study with all these, you know, bits and bobbles, just like Ariel had, I thought that was actually really cute. I was like, okay, that's an actual cool way of saying, oh, they actually have a lot of similarities, not just that, oh, both of their parents suck. And it's just really, it was really interesting just to see, you know, Halle Berry and, let me get the other guy's name up real quick. Jonah Howard King interacting together and their chemistry together. I thought it was really nice. I genuinely believe, like, okay, yeah, they do have a connection here. Now, Eric's complete obliviousness to Ariel as his true love, notwithstanding, to the situation, but I really do think they did a good job with that. It, again, definitely padded way longer than it needed to be. The whole scene in the market and them going in the carriage taking, I think, 5 times as long as the original, but I think it was a good choice they did there, honestly.
So, I'm glad that you brought that up, because that actually kind of mirrors something positive that I do have to say about the remake as well. But it's one of those weird things where it's a positive, but not to the fault of the original. It's just they kind of do something slightly different. And that is how they frame the ending fight with Ursula in the movie, which you mentioned as one of the differences in the synopsis, but Ariel is actually the one that takes Ursula out, which I think... I don't think it's like a necessity that you have to have that happen, but it's a good framing of her character to be directly involved with saving her father, specifically saving her father. Because in the original, I do like this movie, and I always have liked The Little Mermaid, but a weakness that I've always kind of felt is that it doesn't ever seem like Ariel fully learns a lesson until, again, I keep using this phrase, until things are far too late, and the closest she ever gets to that is just she says sorry to King Triton, and then he's turned into this creepy little worm thing. And then at the end,
I'm kind of glad they didn't include. I'm kind of glad they didn't include that scene in the remake. I don't think I could have been okay watching Javier Bardem get turned into a polyp,
turned into a worm.
That was I was kind of dreading that one. I was like, I don't know if I'm.
It's that meme of "Would you still love me if I was a worm?"
The answer is no, with King Triton at least.
but that being said, I do like Ariel's direct involvement in taking down Ursula, and because like I said, it's more direct involvement with her helping to save her father's life, because that feels like she's taking more accountability for the mistakes that she's made, or, you know, her oversight. And I think that's a plus over the original. That being said, I wonder how much of that was their true intent versus just a girl power moment, because the original, I've heard that be something that some people complain about with the original, how Eric is the one that takes the boat and defeats the main villain. And the only arguments I have to that is that, one, it's kind of playing on the history that Disney has with their fairy tale movies, especially their princess movies. Sleeping Beauty comes to mind, where Philip takes out Maleficent. But also, within the movie itself, it's not like, oh, Ariel's a damsel in distress and Eric has to save her, necessarily. It's kind of mirroring a complete picture, because he's almost returning the favor for Ariel saving his life at the beginning of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so I always thought it kind of went hand in hand. So I think that's a positive with the remake. But as always, I'm kind of questioning if I'm reading more into the situation than what they actually intended. And I'm curious as to your thoughts on that.
I'm kind of in a similar boat. Again, I keep making C puns, and I didn't realize how many of those I just have in my normal vocabulary. But I'm kind of in the same headspace of that. I do think it was better to have Ariel do it in the end. But also, yeah, I recognize, paying it back thing in the original of Eric going, oh, you saved my life, now I owe you one. Plus, honestly, I just found it fun how much of a stone-cold badass Eric ends up being in the original. Where he's just like, okay, screw this. I'm done with this. I'm getting on this boat. I'm stabbing a sea monster. And I just think that's kind of fun. Beyond that, I wouldn't be surprised if it was kind of the Disney like girl power thing if they did for the remake. Because they've done some pretty egregious examples of that, at least in especially the Marvel movies. Where they're just trying to kind of be like, feminism, registered trademark. So
here's the thing is that, again, I also want to put out there, I don't inherently think that that's a bad thing to have in your movies.
Right.
But Disney is so obvious the way they play their hands.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard not to notice.
In these new ones, it's a lot more obvious that that's what they're going for. But again, and I'm going to keep doing this a lot, going back to a lot of the other Little Mermaid movies. In the second one, Eric and Ariel have a daughter, Melody. Ha ha, so funny. Her name is a musical song thing. Ends up killing Ursula's like unknown sister from the first movie. From the first movie. And it truly is just like a redemption moment for mother and daughter in rebuilding their relationship. And so it isn't so obvious, wow, we're going to let the woman do it in this story. And I think that the remake does it well, but not as well as they would have done in the early to mid 2000s. Now that we have this full feminist power movement.
Mm-hmm. And I will say, I do also kind of like the fact that Eric did it in the original, simply for the fact of it established early on that he isn't, you know, there's multiple moments, especially with Grimsey's interaction, that he's meant to act more princely. He's meant to act as this symbol of power more than as this adventurer, the seafarer. But in the end, with him piloting the ship, it proves that, oh yeah, he's an extremely skilled seafarer, with the fact that, okay, he's able to get up onto this ship that is mostly rotted from the ocean and use it as an entire weapon. It shows his bravery and ability to pull that off. I don't necessarily buy that Ariel even knew what a steering wheel was. I'm gonna be real. I know this is the most petty thing. This is the most how would she do that when they didn't know what like fire was on the surface? But it's worth noting, like, how did she know what to do exactly? She didn't really study anything about humans in that aspect.
Hmm.
So I just find that funny more than anything, where I kind of thought about that after fact. I was like, oh, wait a minute. How'd she figure that out? It's like, cool moment, but...
Yeah, I was kind of pondering that a little bit too, and like, where are we exactly?
Sorry. More waffling than anything with that one. I just found it funny when I realized it. It was like, okay, yeah. In the first movie, Eric's good at this. And the second one, why?
No, that's fine. I didn't have much on it aside from
honestly.
And also, I just like.
I honestly expected Ariel to actually like enlist sea creatures to help them push the boat in this case, because I was like, okay, now she's going to establish herself as like actually an authority to work with here, and that people are going to want to help out Ariel under the sea. But no, she actually just got up on the boat and steered it. I was like, oh, okay, that's fine.
Yeah, it's about time.
Yeah, cool.
But also, I wanted to go back to The Little Mermaid 2 and just say that I'm glad that we have a quote-unquote Disney expert here on the show that can provide insight such as that, because I had The Little Mermaid 2 on VHS, and I definitely watched it, but I remember nothing of that movie other than a penguin and a walrus being in it. So it's good that we can make these connections, whereas we probably wouldn't be able to do that before.
Yeah, it's the complete opposite mirror of The Little Mermaid, in that Ariel and Eric have a daughter, and they banned her from the sea because the sea is dangerous. And she's like, man, it would be so cool to be a mermaid. And it's so stupid and so silly. But to also throw it back to Lin-Manuel Miranda, there's a song at the end that Sebastian sings that sounds so similar to the Hamilton soundtrack that it really just throws me for a loop every time I hear that song. So maybe that was his initial tie-in.
Maybe. Like, maybe that's what... Did he just, like, basically plagiarize all of Disney's work to make Hamilton? We had that whole video from, you know, the H-Bomber guy about plagiarism online. Let's start bringing that shit up.
Oh, good lord. Yeah, Stu, stay out of my recommended feed. Why don't you?
What are you talking about, your recommended feed, man? That came up online.
Yeah, every time I see it, I'm like, oh, yeah, no thanks. I'm not going to watch that.
It's pretty good.
But anyways, I want to sort of go through some more of the differences that are here, however minor they might be, and just sort of talk about them. The first one that kind of strikes me is he's unnecessary as a character, but I couldn't help but notice that René Auberjonois was cut entirely from the remake.
Oh yeah, the French song, the chef. Yeah. Yeah, that's...
Yeah, nowhere to be found.
I think that would have been a fun little moment. I think it would have been aping a lot of scenes from Ratatouille, but you know what? I'd love to see that.
Les Poissons being cut from the movie was such a loss.
Plus, it's just fun to say, Les Poissons.
Huge, huge loss. But we did get Fathoms Below. Honestly, I don't think any of the songs in the original Little Mermaid movie are weak. I like them all, but if there is a weak one, it'd probably be Fathoms Below, just because it's not a complete song. It's just sort of to take you into the movie. And it is in the remake, but it's kind of structured differently. I think Fathoms Below is after Ariel sings Part of Your World, because it's that night when they're doing the fireworks show.
Yeah, it's more just meant to be like a sea shanty they're singing, which, like, I think that just the part of me that enjoys sea shanties heard it, like, in both cases, I was like, this isn't a super strong song, no. I'm fine with
it. Yeah.
I'm fine, like, the lyrics don't make a whole lot of sense, if we're gonna be honest. But yeah. Also, I mentioned this when we were watching the remake as well. I cannot for the life of me remember where they actually revealed Eric's statue. If, for me, when I was watching it, just all of a sudden it was there in the grotto. I was like, wait, what?
it like slides off the ship.
Okay.
During like the...
Like the storm. Yeah. So for some reason that one just kind of slipped by me. I think I expected more to come of it, but all right.
Yeah. It all just kind of blends together at a certain point.
I gotta say this about... Because that actually does bring up a point that I've kind of realized over the course of thinking about it. There is a general sense of everything kind of bleeding together scene-wise, because the visuals are just not near as strong as the original. My God, some of the visuals they put on display in the original were so cool. Like, even just the glow coming off of Triton's trident,
you got it.
Was fantastic. And just, like, when he starts destroying things in the grotto, where they have, like, this cool, like, glow effect go on them, it's a very distinctive scene, and it's hard to get it out of your mind. But then when that same scene happens in the remake, it all is still kind of the same lighting as from earlier scenes, and we get kind of the cool effect of, you know, an underwater explosion, which is cool enough to see in and of itself, but it just didn't have the same kind of impact to me for some reason. There's not as much of those really almost like dripping with darkness moments, like out in up in the storm, where they actually use actual live storm effects over top of the animation, which I loved personally. But it's just, there's just something about the animation style that it's hard to replicate that, because God, there were some scenes that I really were like, wait, do we already have that scene, or is that scene part of this scene? Or it's really, like you said, everything just kind of bled together.
It's really difficult for me to pick things, specific things out of my memory about the remake at a point, because it is a direct remake with just slight changes. Mm. But I guess one of the main things I can comment on, if I'm going to keep with positives, and try not to sound like a sour bastard, is that at the very least, the visuals and the creature design is just that kind of obnoxious, oh, it's realistic CG creatures, how cool. But since they're able to work with the specificity of, like, the underwater characters, it's not as abhorrent as it could be. Like, it is a shame that the Lion King remake made so much money compared to the Little Mermaid remake, because, honestly, Little Mermaid remake is better. Not by a lot, but it looks better, it plays out better, it's not as grotesque because there are humans that you can look at.
I will say, though, I think Flounder was a bit of a nightmare to look at. I'm going to be real.
No, he was so cute.
I saw this just like actual fish face dude looking up at me talking with a sweet voice. I'm like, ugh.
I didn't mind Flounder's remake design, and I think people gave it too much shit. I did mind Sebastian's remake design, because it's like, okay, yeah, this is just a crab. There's nothing for me to latch onto here.
There were a few moments where he does a bit more expression with his eyes, like when he's on King Triton's shoulder and he kind of gives like a side eye. And I thought, I was like, okay, if they had done more of that with more exaggerated features, this would have been a really good character. But as it is, we're really just looking at this tiny expressionless mouth and just listening to, you know, the sweet voices of what was, you know, Thomas Jefferson and Hamilton. So, but it's just a bit lacking in everything as far as a character. Also, it's weird. I found it weird that they just kind of completely nixed the fact that he was the court composer. Like, he's just a major domo in the remake, rather than having all this personality and everything where he's talking about, like my career as a composer is ruined and all these things. It's like, it adds a lot of personality that the character really thrives on. And this other one, he's just kind of a dude. It's just like, I am just Jamaican man. I'm going after the daughter of the king.
Yeah. I mean, that's something I couldn't help but notice overall, is that they added all these unnecessary tweaks to the human world to flesh out this human environment and these different human characters, with the exception of Louis, who they cut. Mm-hmm. But they have all this here, but the underwater kingdom is, like, practically non-existent. We don't see a lot of merfolk aside from the mermaids, because it's not actually a kingdom. It's Triton, and then each of the daughters is, like, one of the seven seas or whatever. And then we have Flounder, and we have Sebastian. But all these other fish, again, that goes back to the under the sea thing where Halle Bailey has to step in to sing harmony with Sebastian. I guess none of these other fish can talk. None of them have any, like, actual, they're all just, like, dumb creatures that exist within their environment to just eat and do whatever. I understand that for the shark. That's the same thing in the original, but I don't know. Where's the seahorse that works for King Triton's horse? Where's he?
There's not even a castle.
Yeah.
It's just, like, a random rock. Yeah. It's just has a couple seats in it.
It's just a naturally formed, like, stalactite underwater, which, yeah, those exist, but these are people. They have hands. They can carve and build shit. Why did we not do that?
Also, Daddy, are we poor? No, we're not poor.
What threw me off so much is the idea that Ariel's grotto is really not that hidden.
No.
This very obvious sea of seaweed is, like, hiding this huge grotto of human stuff. There's no way that one of her sisters or some other random merfolk person would have not found her grotto with all this weird human stuff in it.
Mm. And also, kind of in a similar vein, where they explore the shipwreck in the very beginning in the original, it just looks like a solitary shipwreck kind of at the bottom of this ocean. It's like, okay, yeah, that's fine. Nothing too extraordinary. In the remake, they're in the fucking graveyard of ships. Like, we are talking the Spanish Armada went down here. What the hell is this island? That's all of these, like, armies of ships just built up in this one spot. It made no sense to me.
I was led to believe that Triton is an evil figure that is personally destroying all of these ships.
Honestly, I wish
his wife died.
I think, because, like, it feels like at times the queen of the service world kind of leans into that, being like, oh, it's the ocean gods fucking with us, that she is fully a full believer of. I was thinking that they were going to lean into that a bit more, of like, oh yeah, King Triton just is a dick. Like, it's Ursula was not much of a downgrade. Oh, it's just so wild. That's all the random things they do with the underwater compared to the up top. Which, also, with the fact that they did flesh out the surface world, I gotta say, as a human, I've seen a lot of that stuff before. Why did they focus on that? Like, they could have focused on the part of the world that we've, as humans, don't get to experience. That being the ocean.
Because Ariel's never experienced that.
But
yeah,
it's boring
to live through Ariel.
But
this movie is called The Little Mermaid. The Little Human.
I know.
The Little Steward Under the Sea.
But I'm not a mermaid. I'm a dude. So I don't know. I just found that funny, kind of thinking about, like, with the comparisons of the two. They take all the time to flesh out up top, but then they downgrade the ocean for some reason. It's like, how do you make the ocean look boring, y'all? It's the ocean. It's the scariest place on Earth.
Did you laugh? Did you laugh when Jodie Benson showed up in the remake? Did you slap your thighs together with glee?
I was excited.
I was just like, oh, cool.
It's just, there's a number of things that I can continue to gripe about or complain. Like, sure. The Ursula, I know, and now I have something else to talk about because I reminded myself. Why, I know that you said you weren't looking forward to Triton being turned into a polyp, but why did they, it's not like they were averse to creepy undersea creatures to begin with. Why didn't they just go that route? During the Under the Sea, or not the Under the Sea, good lord, during Poor Unfortunate Soul, as opposed to Ursula, you know, paying the price, Ursula collects these sea creatures to, like, live in her garden, which is a very, like, Harlan Ellison, I have no mouth, but I'm a scream sort of ending.
Yeah.
She just holds up a bunch of skulls, and it's like, oh, she kills them. I don't know, one's a lot worse than the other.
Yeah.
That felt kind of weak.
I will say, Ursula very much did hold on to the idea of like being truly a sea hag, like, or just even just like a mythological hag in general, of like bargaining and losing. That means you lose yourself fully, versus the new one's basically just a like a sea predator, not like a killing people thing, not the other kind of predator.
I will say that they do flesh out the relationship between her and King Triton a lot more in the remake, which I do appreciate. In the first one, there's no correlation between the kingdom of Atlantica, thank you. And there's like no correlation between Ursula being the sea witch and King Triton's kingdom. And I kind of appreciate that they threw in like, this is my brother and sister. This is a loss of power situation. This is her revenge story. It just makes it make more sense.
I think there might just be like a tiny brief throwaway line in the original that Ursula had been in power, maybe, but that I might be wrong there.
Well, she says that she lived in the palace.
Yeah, that was
it.
Yeah, so there was something going on there, but it was never really established. For all we knew, that for like when I first saw the original, and even when we saw it again when we were rewatching it for this, I was kind of convinced like, oh, they're just exes. Like, this is just like they totally used to do shit together. And Triton was like, hey, I think I'd rule better, and kick her ass out. But yeah, also that sibling relationship probably works better.
I do really wish that they had made Melissa McCarthy up more. Like, they gave her the hairdo, God, yeah. But, like, to go back to the beginning of the show, I really do wish that she was more arch and had more of that divine kind of influence.
I agree
on
with
her
that.
Wardrobe.
It was very disappointing to, like, learn about the history of Ursula and, like, her being very influenced by divine. And that was just very lost. The makeup was not done very well to begin with. But then to truly take away that influence in the original is kind of disappointing. Her comedy and her humor... And Poor Unfortunate Souls is brilliant, but the visuals were just not there. Her grotto, her makeup, it just wasn't there for me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I will say, though, I'm trying to decide whether I like the scene. There was another padded scene where they have her about to cast her spell to, like, become the doppelganger, where they padded out more in this one, where she's like, where's my stuff? No, it's been lost. Oh, here it is. I can't decide whether I found that really funny or really annoying. So it feels like it harkens back to like when we did the remake of Ghostbusters, where it felt like a very SNL joke, where it was just like this thing of building up. Oh, like, you know, big dramatic moment, and then, oh, silliness to undercut it. It's like, it's fine, I mean, but it just seems kind of like an odd addition here.
I think I'm kind of of the same mind I was on that Ghostbusters podcast, where I was like, Melissa McCarthy is very funny, and I think she's a very funny comedian, but I don't think they're giving her like too many funny things to do or say. She has some funny readings in the remake. I will give her that.
Oh, yeah, fantastic.
No bones about it. But, yeah, I mean, how much of that goes down to the performance versus... I mean, that's the same thing I said about Halle Bailey's singing. It's like, how much of that is the singing versus how much of it is the direction for the singing? Because, I mean, to go back to Ashman and Menken, you have this very specific directing style with the vocal performances. Like, when in Beauty and the Beast, where Howard Ashman's literally on his deathbed and he tells Paige O'Hara to... deliver her lines as if she were Streisand, to give her that specific pause. Or like when Alan Menken was directing Danny DeVito on Hercules, and he's during the song, he's like, think Durante, so that DeVito does it in a more staccato way. I don't think that sort of direction was there for the actors, whether it be singing or their performances. I think that they got all these big names and then they just kind of had them do things.
Yeah.
Sounds very reductive.
Which, like, I mean, story. I mean, when you talk about a synopsis of Disney's, you know, model of in the last few years, of they got a bunch of big names and basically didn't direct them. They just wanted the names themselves. And I feel like that kind of is the whole feel of the remake as a whole. Like, it's, and the fact that we've talked entirely about the remake essentially is kind of testament to that. The original is so solid in its direction and its presentation and its art style and everything that it's hard to really even pick anything out about it. And the fact that the remake basically just takes all of that and just effectively just reduces it for the sake of the feature length or the impact, like the societal impact. Like, we know, like, let's be straight up, they knew full well what they were doing when they recast Ariel to be non-white in any capacity. Like, they knew that I was gonna probably kick up a shitstorm, and that probably built up a lot of hype around it. And I don't know, I find certain aspects of it a bit schemey, and I can't really. Like, Halle Bailey, I think, was fantastic, as is. You know, I think, like you said, the direction for her singing wasn't always great.
You mean Halle Bailey?
Halle Bailey, sorry, my bad. Halle Bailey was great in the role. But, I don't know, it seemed a bit soulless at times with a lot of the feelings of it. And I wish I could like it more than I did. That's the best I can say about it. It's like, I enjoyed it far more than I expected to. I wish I enjoyed it more. Simply because I think the things they tried to do, it's indicative of what a remake should be. Fleshing out things that weren't fleshed out. adding a bit more kind of extant parts to things that weren't necessarily worked on, and just having a bit more fun with the setting. But it just didn't have the life in it as the original did, and it's kind of hard to ignore that.
Yeah. I mean, I'm of similar mind, and I do feel bad we didn't talk about the original as much, but there's not much to say that I didn't already say in relation to the remake. I think that the songs were great and well orchestrated. I think the colors are fantastic, especially since you have this different environment of the underwater sequences, and you can see how that compares to the last time Disney really messed with underwater in an animated sense, which probably would have been whatever the hell that movie was with Don Knotts. Incredible Mr. Limpet, I think.
Oh, I have no idea.
And before that, I guess probably would have been Pinocchio. But at any rate, it's a great movie, and it's kind of a soulless cash grab remake, which is the ongoing theme with these things. And yeah, like I said, I think Halle Bailey's fine. I don't care for her much as an actress, but I think she's a great singer. It's just hard to look past how obvious and calculated Disney's decisions are. And, I mean, we saw this with Aladdin, we saw this with The Lion King. It's going to make money because they're pulling from specific movies that everyone adores and remembers from the Disney. I mean, look at Roger Ebert, or look at where we were with animation at the time when The Little Mermaid for Disney came around. Like, even with Don Bluth starting up his shit with, like, Land Before Time and Secret and Him and whatever, animation still wasn't in a great place theatrically, so The Little Mermaid comes out. That was Roger Ebert's favorite animated film until the day he died. He would always, every time a new animated movie came out, he would compare it to The Little Mermaid and say, well, it's good, but it's not The Little Mermaid. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's one of those things where I do have some faults with the original, but they pale in comparison to a lot of what went on with this remake. So I definitely showed my hand like 5 seconds into the podcast. I'm well aware, but
yeah, well, I think we all went into this with that mentality, unless Hannah's going to come out of left field and be like, the remake's better.
No, the remake is not better, and I feel like I made that very clear at the beginning.
Okay, fair.
I don't think that almost any remake that Disney has made at this point will ever be better than the original. I think that they are preying on and capitalizing on this drive. Oh my gosh, sorry, our dogs is drafting us again. This drive for nostalgia, especially after COVID-19, because that's going to influence a lot of this conversation as well. And I think, I agree. I wouldn't say it's soulless compared to some of the other remakes, Lion King. Mm-hmm. But I would say that it will not hail in comparison to one of the greatest animated pieces that Disney has made.
Yeah, I think that's about as a good way to put it as possible.
Yeah, I'm actually curious, though, because I talked about The Jungle Book briefly and Stu talked about Beauty and the Beast. I don't know how many of the remakes you've seen, if you've seen them all or just a subset, but do you have a preferred Disney remake, Hannah?
You know, I'm actually Googling this right now because I don't remember what Disney remakes at this point. I'm trying to see here. There's so many now. I forgot they even remade Mulan. Mulan's one of my top ones.
That one had a lot of controversy around it. So,
I mean, all of these have had controversy.
Around that one in particular, because
oh, the camps.
Like, yeah, that.
Yeah, that was big controversy. They just had Cruella that just came out. Forget about that.
Oh yeah.
I'm trying to see here. Holy cow, they've had so many remakes.
Technically, the Chip and Dale movie,
which I thought was hilarious.
I guess that's a remake of a show. Not even a remake, I guess it's like a sequel to the show.
I don't know. I think I'd have to say that this is probably my favorite remake so far. Now, I haven't seen all of them, so I haven't seen the Jungle Book remake. I have seen Alice in Wonderland. I've seen Lion King. I've seen quite a few. But this is probably my favorite remake so far. But I think that's biased by my love for the original. Lion King is okay. Sure. It's brilliant. The original, I mean. But the remake fell very short. And so there's just a lot of the remakes that fall very short just because I don't have that heart for it like I do the original. And so I think that The Little Mermaid is probably my favorite remake so far just because I adore the original piece.
That's fair.
I don't suppose you have a favorite remake.
Me?
Yeah. Sorry, I guess that...
Jungle Book.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah, you did say that. Sorry.
It would have to be The Jungle Book, yeah.
I don't even know what I'd pick, if any.
I just assumed it would be Beauty and the Beast, but...
I mean, maybe. I think I just like the designs in Beauty and the Beast, but even then, rewatching it in later periods, I'm like, oh, yeah, this is a CG fest out the wazoo.
I mean, surely it wouldn't be Aladdin.
No, good lord, no. I don't know. I don't know if I can necessarily say if I had to pick one. Yeah, it would have to be Beauty and the Beast. I think the design they did work with on that one's pretty cool. but that's just me, because mainly just because I think the Codsworth looks like it's a very cool character that they made fully realized.
That's fair.
I will add my last opinion piece to this, that I much prefer when Disney remakes it on the Broadway stage than when they do in a CGI live action movie. They take much more care and effort and appreciation for the original piece than I think these remakes do. And so that's my piece of advice. If you had the opportunity to see a live stage version of it, I would go see that over a remake of the movie, at least in the Disney versions and what they're doing.
Sure.
Yeah.
I think I'll have to. I need to catch more stage just in general. I've seen The Lion King on stage as far as the Disney ones go, but I'm sorely lacking in that field.
Well, I think with each of our opinions known, I wanted to pose a question to you, Jake, kind of in the subject of remakes specifically, which is kind of the whole point of the show, but you'll understand when I say with the question. With our questions for this week, I actually came up with one prior. We've done a lot of remakes where we've seen, at least a fair number of remakes, where we've seen animated films get turned into live action. What is, in your opinion, a good movie that would be cool to remake from live action into an animated piece? The other way
live
around.
Live action into animated.
Yes.
Oh, man.
Kind of very, you know, Ghostbusters turned into the Ghostbusters cartoon TV show kind of thing, but for a whole movie.
Jeez. I mean, that's, I don't know. That's a weird one. I mean, my initial response, just because I would hope it would be, like, really strange in the same vein of, like, a Fantastic Planet, would be a David Lynch picture.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe Blue Velvet. That would be very creepy.
That'd be wild.
Yeah, that would be just bizarre. Maybe something more off-kilter, like The Swimmer.
I personally don't know that one.
Sort of, there could be good visuals with sort of the swimming between different pools. It's a movie based on a short story. It stars Burt Lancaster. Basically, he leaves a party, and the path that he takes home from the party is swimming through various pools in people's backyard, and each one sort of triggers a flashback that explains bits about his life and his interactions with people. And I think that just from, like, a dreamlike state, you might be able to get some good animation out of that, maybe.
See that.
But, man, no, yeah, on the spot, that's a good question. What about the two of you?
Well, for me, the one I had kind of thought of with this question was, I would love to see Goodfellas remade into an anime-styled Yakuza movie. I know it's based off a true story, the true story of Henry Hill, who is an Italian-American mobster. But I think that would actually make a very cool, like, kind of Akira-style kind of like Yakuza mob piece. I think that'd be really interesting to see how it gets retranslated in kind of the, like, you know, kind of Tokyo scene, which I know they're not necessarily in a major city in, you know, in Goodfellas. They're kind of more on the periphery, I think, of New York. But I think, yeah, I think that'd be a really cool one to see. I think just seeing that story kind of retranslated for that context would be interesting. But what about you, Hannah?
So I think this is just because it's stuck on the brain. But I would love to see a remake of Thelma and Louise in the animation style of The Iron Giant. Like a very Warner Brothers, like 90s, Brad Bird. Yes, very much that animation style. I think it'd be such a brilliant film translated with that animation style, telling the story, the car drive up at the end. It'd be so good.
Yeah, that's a good one. I think, yeah, that would lend itself really well with the Brad Bird style. I wasn't expecting that one, honestly. Like, see, it's cool now that I'm showing you so many more movies. Good. You can draw from more sources. It's cool.
I also thought about Forrest Gump in that same style.
Also good.
Fascinating.
Also good.
Oh, wow. That might make that movie, like, enjoyable for me. If it was, like,
those are fighting words, buddy. I think that's one of your favorite movies, right, Hannah?
That is one of my favorite movies, but I do respect opinions. So I totally understand that movie is not for everybody. I adore it, and I love it.
I'm not trying to start a fight.
Oh, yeah, no. We're all friendly here. Don't worry. Also, for some reason, just the thought popped in my head, in the similar vein, basically mixing both of ours, Forrest Gump, but in the style of Sailor Moon.
That is...
Oh?
Not good.
It's curse, I know. But I thought about that, but I was thinking, like, that very, like, 90s kind of kawaii style anime. For some reason, I was just thinking that in the context of Forrest Gump. I'm like, that would be hilarious.
I was trying to be nice. That's awful.
No, that's fair. I know it's awful. I knew it when I said it. Don't worry.
How about John Carpenter, specifically John Carpenter's take on In the Mouth of Madness,
oh, God.
But from the lens of, like, Masaki Yuasa.
Ooh. Okay, that'd be wild.
There you go. That's my final entry.
All right, cool. Very, very, very high art on that one. Well, compared to, you know, mine. Just being like, Goodfellas, but Yakuza.
Yours is fine. Yeah, come on.
Fair.
I could see that. Maybe it's just because Tokyo Godfathers is on the brain, but I could see a Satoshi Kon like Yakuza picture, like Goodfellas.
That'd be cool. But any questions for you to pose to us this time around?
Me? No.
All right, cool. I was just curious. It's
there's a very good one.
Yeah, I like being able to kind of find, you know, there's a very good idea of yours to have these little kind of what if questions at the end. And it's just,
well, thank you.
I'm trying to think of like if there's been any straight live action Disney flicks that could have been good as animated ones, but there's not a ton of original live actions from Disney that I can really think of, honestly.
I was about to say there are like tons and tons of them, but they're all like dumped into the nothing hole.
Right. Yeah. There's a lot of Disney Channel originals.
$1 million duck. That too.
I was about to say an animated Newsies would be amazing.
Ooh, that'd be fun.
Oh yeah.
Bring back Christian Bale.
If we're going back to the Menken Ashman thing, because I think that was entirely Alan Menken, wasn't it?
I believe so, yeah. And they, again, another one that they stage adapted, but not animated, and it would be brilliant.
See, now I'm just trying to think of more cursed ones.
Okay, well, maybe while you think of cursed ones, I can do our socials real quick. How about that?
Go right ahead, bud.
Okay. Go ahead and follow us on any of your favorite podcasting platforms. Leave a like, review, favorite, comment, whatever the medium may be. We're on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Podbay, Podmatic, Spreaker, iHeartRadio, YouTube, and the like, but we're hosted on Spotify for podcasters. Go ahead and send us an email, theyremadeit@gmail.com, with thoughts about the show, good or bad, things that we could cover in the future. If you have an idea for something, we've taken suggestions in the past, and we're always open to them. So that's the email. Send it.
We always seem to get very unexpected answers for things to remake, and those are our favorite.
Yes, things that we weren't considering. And go ahead and follow us at It Remade on Twitter for updates on when podcasts are going to be going live, things that we might be covering in the future, little full circle diagrams I put together regarding people that we've talked about on the show more than once, and posters and various things for items we've talked about on the show before, you know, what we've been watching, reading, playing, etc. And it's a fairly, you know, that account gets traction. I mentioned in the past, we've been retweeted by Eric Bauza. I think that we were retweeted by the official account for Everspace 2 the other day.
Of all things.
So, very bizarre traction with that Twitter account. But that's it for socials.
We're going to hear from the Everspace 2, folks. I like your game. I'm sorry it didn't get more popular.
Tell them that you want me on the show more. I'm just kidding.
No. Hey, please also say that. I like having her here. It's fun. Also, I think I've come up with the most cursed thing I could come up with. Shawshank Redemption in the style of Robot Chicken.
Ew.
I just saw Hannah like visually gag.
I thought your other
isn't
one was
like
awful.
That they
just like the like over exaggerated movements and everything and like the weird dialogue and just like this the weird like, you know, strawberry jam gore scenes and everything. Yeah, that, but Shawshank Redemption.
I mean, you literally have a frame of reference for what this would look like because Robot Chicken did a Shawshank Redemption parody with Batman villains.
Oh,
if I remember correctly.
Oh, I need to see this.
It's like Black Manta is the Morgan Freeman, and the Joker is the Tim Robinson part. Tim Robbins, I mean.
Yeah. Oh, that's fantastic. I know what I'm looking up after this.
Great.
I know that. That was the most cursed one I could come up with. I will not torture us with thinking of it any longer.
What a great way to end the show.
Of course. But I wanted to personally thank my lovely partner Hannah for being here today to be our resident expert. It seemed you and Jake got on just fine with your knowledge of Disney and that sort of thing. I'm definitely lacking in that department. So thank you for being here. Any final words for our viewers we have, or listeners, whatever?
That's such a bad way to put me on the spot.
I'm so sorry. I mean, that's a good way to close it. we've had worse ways to close it, I promise.
Just keep listening. It's a great show. I can tell that you guys are both really passionate about what you're doing. Obviously, I've been like listening, like not to the show specifically, but I've been listening when Stuart does his quips when we're in the house trying to keep our dog quiet. And you can truly tell that it's something that you guys both enjoy. There's a lot of podcasts now that are very much money grab podcasts, or they're like YouTubers who are trying to extend their lives as celebrities. But I actually truly enjoy podcasts where the guests and the hosts and things like that truly enjoy what they're doing and truly enjoy what they're talking about. And that's what I appreciate about you guys and this show. And it was really cool to be a part of that day.
Thank you, baby.
Oh, thank you. That's so sweet.
And as a fun fact to kind of put this out on, when Hannah and I first got together, This was just when Jake and I were beginning the show, and our next episode was going to be Blade Runner. And I decided, as one of the first things to do with my new girlfriend who I wanted to impress, was to invite her at the time to my basement apartment and show her Blade Runner, the first movie we really watched together. I don't know how I still have a relationship, people. It's been 6 years. I am a very lucky man. I don't know why you stayed with me, baby.
I just saw the passion there about movies.
All right, yeah, fair.
Oh.
Fellas, that's how you do it. Be passionate about things.
Got it.
Well, I think that'll about wrap me as far as I can go. As always, I am your host, Stuart.
And I'm your host, Jacob.
And?
I am your guest, Hannah.
Thank you all so much for listening.
Sebastian, I know you've been keeping something from me.
Keeping something?
About Ariel.
Ariel?
In love?
I tried to stop us. She wouldn't listen. I told her to stay away from humans. They are bad. They are trouble.
What about humans?
Humans? Who said anything about humans?